We have got Tom Sell from Combat Sell Associates and Rich Morrison from NAU Country. They're an insurance company. One thing that before they start, I want to remind everyone, you actually got three forms to fill out, evaluation forms. There's two that look like this. They're blue and green. We are working with RMA specifically on this effort to deliver crop insurance and risk management training. If you would fill this form out, it would be extremely helpful for us as we move forward in that effort. So make sure you fill these out and then give them back to us at the end. One, of course, is a pre you can fill out now, and one of them is a post to fill out afterwards. So with that, Tom Sell from Combest Sell & Associates is going to talk crop insurance issues.
Well, thanks, John, and welcome, everyone, and thanks to the sorghum producers for putting on this this informational session. I hope it's of value to you guys in the audience. Let me introduce myself first. I'm Tom Sell. I'm from Combest Sell & Associates. We're a lobbying firm in D.C. Now, before you start chunking rocks, I just want to say that we consider the work we get to do in representing our nation's agricultural interests in Washington, D.C., before, for all of its frustrations, the best government ever invented over the most just and great nation that's ever existed. It's a real honor to get to do that work in Washington, D.C. And as lobbyists, we've effectively exercised your First Amendment rights, right, to freedom of speech and to petition your government. So we gather together in groups like the National Sorghum Producers, or the Minnesota Corn Growers, Tim Weibel, my great friend, in the audience. And we gather together and we try and speak with a unified voice. And there's strength in numbers, right? And Lord knows we need it in agriculture. A nation of 330 million people with a representative democracy where we're all supposedly represented. And only 2.1 million farmers in that nation of 330 billion. So, what, we're sitting at about two-thirds of 1% of our nation's population? In a Congress where there are 435 representatives, each representing 750,000 people, each one congressman represents 750,000 people, that means that three congressmen could represent all the farmers in this nation. In fact, you guys, as the farmers, are spread out over about 70 congressional districts. That's 70 out of the 435, but keep in mind you have to have 218 votes to get anything done or to defend yourself within the U.S. Congress, 61 in the Senate, 218 in the House. And so it is so vitally important that ag stick together and work for one another's interests, because this industry that you guys represent is one of the great blessings to this nation that really makes it work year after year. There's a reason why President Trump is so appreciative of the farmer and talks about you guys all the time, ad nauseum. I've worked in Washington, D.C. since 1995, and we used to just pine for a president to say one nice word about farmers. And rarely would it happen. Once in a while, maybe at the signing of a farm bill or something like that. But this president, my gosh, it's every other day. And he speaks at the Commodity Classic, or he sends a video, and he speaks to the American Farm Bureau, 3 years running now. So it's a remarkable thing. It's an interesting time in Washington, D.C. So how did I get into this? Well, I went to Washington, D.C. right out of college. I was an ag economics student out west of here in the wild west of Lubbock, Texas, at Texas Tech University, the finest university in the land for Kansas City Chiefs, the home school, the breeding ground for Patty Mahomes, who thank you very much. So that's, and I took an internship to go to Washington, D.C., and I fell in with who later became my partner, but was my congressman at the time, Larry Combest, who served honorably from 1985 to 2003, was the chairman of the Ag Committee during a very similar and very difficult time in agriculture from 1999 to 2003. And really, remember those commodity prices really slid, starting in 1997, then we had this 98, 99, 2000, 2001, what a grind, 2002, it was just awful. But that presented some legislative opportunities. And during that time, we were able to accomplish some significant gains in specifically In 2000, well, we did a lot of ad hoc disaster during that time, recall that, kind of a corollary to the MFP of these days. But in 2000, we were able to say we've got to have a better system than these ad hoc disaster programs. And we need to invest in federal crop insurance. And so we did the ARPA, the Ag Risk Protection Act of 2000, and injected new money into that system to improve the premium assistance side of the equation and to really invest in the buy-up levels to try and get producers to higher levels of buy-up. So we did that, and then a year and a half later, we followed up with the 2002 Farm Bill, which really tried to restore the safety net within the farm program. So that's my history in the background. After that, I went back to law school and then kind of got sucked back into Washington, D.C., as that city tends to do, providing expertise and advice on policy matters before the federal Congress, and thus a registered lobbyist. Hopefully, after all that was an attempt on my part to help you have a little bit better view of what lobbyists do for you in Washington, D.C. I think it's important work, and I can tell you, whether you like it or not, I love the work because I love representing farmers in Washington, D.C. Okay, so I've taken up a lot of time already, but my goal this afternoon was to try and talk about risk management from the federal governmental side. And really, federal crop insurance has just taken the day in that area. And so I'm going to focus in on what really makes crop insurance different, why it has become such an important program, why it is so popular in Washington, D.C., where despite some critics always putting their bullseye on crop insurance and wanting to take it down, take the federal government's role in federal crop insurance out of the equation, we've been able to withstand those attacks. And I think there are some fundamental reasons for that. Let's see, John, if I can figure this out. So I tried to just back out and say, what are the key things that make federal crop insurance different? And I have these 7 points. I'm actually going to break them out where you can see them a little bit better. The first is that it is a competitive business model that empowers the farmer. Now, this isn't the case with disaster programs that where all the power is in the Congress and what they might do for you. But in crop insurance, quite literally, you have your fate in your own hands. You purchase according to what you need. It's based on your experience on your farm for the most part. There are some fancier products that are out there that you can hedge risks in other ways, but fundamentally, it's in your control. There are a lot of options. I think there are about 180 different crops covered, and there are all kinds of options within those crops. How many of you would say there may be too many options? It's kind of like what Secretary Perdue was saying about having to do FaceTime in the grocery store this morning. The problems we have is there are so many good options, and that's a great thing. Rates are set by USDA, and that's a good thing. It's done so that there's not disparate treatment among you as growers, and we're all concerned about equal treatment in this world. Now, you are rated according to your experience, and you can't get away from that data, but those rates are set by USDA, and they're meant to be fair and to prevent cherry picking for the biggest farmers. And then competition for your business goes to provides the best information and services. The fact that we have agents that are out there competing for your business, if you're not shopping around, you should be. You should be looking for the best agent, because I can promise you, the better agents are providing a really high quality service out there. We're fortunate to get to represent some of the best agents in the land in Washington, D.C. They're a group called CEPA, the Crop Insurance Professionals Association, and they take a great deal of pride in what they do. So I know there are all kinds of agents out there, and there's good and bad, just like in everything. The point here is, as a farmer, you have the power to shop around and to get the best deal you possibly can. They're competing for your business. Second, this program is accountable. Rates and prices are established by actual experience. They're set by RMA based on the state and county experience. Farmer rated relative to others in the county. We already talked about that. You can't get away from the numbers, but it brings accountability into the system. It's also important to note here that if there's monkey business going on, that's hurting you in your county. And so you need to report that. You need to get it into the system so that it can be weeded out. By and large, backing away from the data Crop insurance has a really good story, and we'll look at some of that data in a bit. It's designed to give the farmer every incentive to maximize your production. Better experience for you, by you equals lower rates. So the better experience you have, the lower you'll be paying for the amount of insurance coverage that you can get. And that's an important element to the design of federal crop insurance. Also designed for meaningful indemnification in cases of loss. So I'm sure everyone in the room would say crop insurance has saved my bacon at some point. That's what it's designed for. That's how it's supposed to work. The APH is one of the critical components of the federal crop insurance system, and it's designed to offer strong and relevant protection based on 10 years of actual data. We've actually had some significant improvements that have been made to the APH in recent history. The APH was actually created prior to the 1994 legislation that really started the boost of and the investment in federal crop insurance. It's been improved over time with plugs, 70% of T plug. There's also a trend yield system that was developed by Gary Schnitke at the University of Illinois, and I'm sure many of you are utilizing that. And then a yield exclusion that was a feature of the 2014 Farm Bill that also has enhanced what farmers can cover on their farm. So we all know in federal crop insurance one of the big safeguards is the deductible, and deductibles are high, right? When you actually look at them in terms of dollars, most of you are buying somewhere between 50 and 85% crop insurance or levels of buy-up. 85% equals a 15% deductible. 75% equals a 25% deductible. You have to lose 25% of your crop before you start being indemnified. So the deductibles are significant. If I think there's one area where you're going to see future focus and investment in federal crop insurance by the Congress, if we can get there, if we get to a point again where we say, look, keep in mind, we've had ad hoc disaster the last 3 years, right? 17, 18, and 19. And I've gotten more than a handful of texts this morning, given the press announcement that came out of USDA today about details of WIP Plus. But the questions are, I need more details. What is this actually going to look like? My farmers are out there trying to talk with their banker right now. And the answer is, we don't know. That's never the case with federal crop insurance. You know what you've bought, and you know what's coming your way. And I'd argue it's a better way to run the railroad. It's better than waiting hand in mouth on Congress to act through federal ad hoc disaster. So if they get some new money to inject into the federal crop insurance system, this is the area that I think you're going to see it invested. That would be trying to minimize the deductible that you have, trying to get higher levels of federal crop insurance, that and the price side. Okay. Another key point, there's contractual certainty between the farmer and the AIP. You know, your contract is not with the federal government. It's with an AIP that serves you, whether it's, I've seen several that are actually represented in the room. There are 15 great companies that help manage this risk for the federal government. USDA can be a referee. It's a rules-based system, and so there are always questions on rules, right? And little words that can befuddle little contracts. And so there's always some arguments, and you have a great referee that's fundamentally is pro-farmer in the USDA. You have agents that generally are on your side, but that contract is between you and the AIP. And the great side of that is if you have an indemnity, they are legally obligated to pay you, and that's a certainty. Next, the goal is to take politics out of disaster and give power to the producer. This is a bit of what I was talking about just a while ago. It's designed to eliminate the need for ad hoc disaster programs. And look, between 2005, after we kind of got through the implementation of the O2 Farm Bill and the federal crop insurance bill was kind of fully in place, between 2005 and 2017, we didn't have any ad hoc disaster. And that was a better time. You know, that was a 12-year run by historical standards in Washington, D.C. That's remarkable. It certainly begs the question, I believe, is it time to reinvest or do the next investment in crop insurance to make it fully meet the need going forward. It's also not designed to be static, but continue to advance and improve. We have a 508H process by which new policies can be developed. Of course, the most exciting policy out there right now that everyone's asking questions about is what? Hemp. Somebody said it. So there's a new hemp product out there. In certain states, be careful. It has to be approved in your county. It's only in the limited counties, and they really tried to do it in a conservative way to both protect the producer and the taxpayer. so that we don't have a big boondoggle out here. I think it's actually a pretty good product, but it is fairly conservative. So you can ask your agent if it's available in your area. Finally, the value of crop insurance is the security is in the security relative to the indemnity. I just wanted to include this because, you know, sometimes you will hear economists or whatnot, and they'll just say, "Oh, federal crop insurance isn't a good deal because you it only paid this money. They had less than a 1.0 loss ratio, so farmers didn't get any value out of it. They had a good year." Well, that's a great thing. You know, my point here is the value that you get out of federal crop insurance isn't the indemnity at the end of the year. Hopefully, Lord willing, you don't get one. But the security, you know, the fact that you can leverage your dollars in other ways, the fact that by protecting yourself on the downside risk, you can invest in better machinery or invest your time in a better way, is a real value to your farm. So the farmers who are you're really using crop insurance well have some of the lowest loss ratios out there. The guys and gals who are using it well and to their advantage are those who are taking the fact that they don't have to lose sleep over a worst case scenario, and they're using their mental energy and their creativity and their assets to improve their farm. So we see this political success in the numbers. And this chart just maps out for the various commodities, and I separated out sorghum. So the scale on the left shows the overall liability coverage by crop for the major program crops. The one on the right is for sorghum, obviously a smaller acreage crop. But you can see this trend over time. Now, you see a bump where we had big prices. Don't we yearn for those days again? 11, 12. Maybe not know so much the drought, but boy, the prices were awesome. So you had higher liability in those times. Those have come back some. But you can see overall, this has been tremendous growth over the course of this program. This chart starts in 1989. So you can see some great growth over time. Also, I think these numbers are interesting. One of the challenges I face in Washington, D.C. is just that crop insurance is under attack. You know, we have these foes or folks who work against farming in Washington, D.C., believe it or not. People are disagreeable up there, particularly those who don't like farm policy. And it's a strange group. It's really a group that kind of meets on the underbelly of the political spectrum. So you have the far-left environmentalists, like the EWG, that want to publish your data all over the place and talk about how rich farmers get subsidized all the time. I can't stand those guys, and we work against them all the time. And on the right, you have the American Enterprise Institute and other kind of more libertarian organizations that want to make a big deal out of the federal budget but don't really have the courage to take on the big spenders. So they go after the 0.25% of the federal budget that is federal ag programs. That's both Title I and crop insurance put together. We spend in federal crop insurance about, the estimates are always running between $8 and $9 billion a year. At times they'll spike up above that. The great news, and what this chart bears out, is that in actuality, over time, we're spending a lot less. We never meet the estimates. So if you look at this, that first row on the top is estimates at the time of the 08 passage. This is what was estimated for the farm bill for the crop insurance title of the farm bill to spend, $7.45 billion over the 10-year average. In actuality, over that time, we were well below that at $6.95 billion. At the estimates at the 14 Farm Bill passage, they estimated $8.68 billion a year. This is when it really did. EWG actually they published a target, and they moved it over to crop insurance. And they said, we're going to try and take down crop insurance in the 14 Farm Bill. At that time, they were estimating $8.68 billion in spending. Since that 14 Farm Bill, we've only averaged $6.32 billion a year. Contrast that also to the crop year indemnities. This is actually what is paid out year after year, and we've averaged $8.38 billion in payouts. So the cost to the taxpayer is that lower number, just over $6 billion. What's actually landed in your pocket in federal crop insurance and indemnities is $8.38. Now, as I said earlier, that's not the best measure of the value of crop insurance. The best value of measure of the value is the risk that you've been able to put aside. You know, how you've been able to leverage those dollars in better ways on your farm. But we shouldn't neglect to point out that, in fact, this is a great taxpayer investment. We're spending $6.3 billion as taxpayers a year. And actually, you get in indemnities over $8 billion. That's pretty remarkable. Hard to design a federal program that would work so well. But we've done it in federal crop insurance. You can see there on the bottom just what the estimates are today when we passed, or this is on based on the latest CBO estimate. So still, they're predicting over $8 billion, and I'd be willing to bet you that we will come in below those estimates again. It's a very efficient program. There are great options. I have this five key products for sorghum because we did this for them, but really this goes for everyone in the room. There are revenue plans, area revenue plans, supplemental coverage option, which is what stacks on top of your underlying plan. So if it's individual insurance, your buy-up, then you can stack an area-based plan on top of it. That's what the ARPs and the ARPIs are. SEO was a feature of the 14 Farm Bill. But I think as we get into this Farm Bill sign-up, you'll see it used more and more. It can only be used if you choose PLC on the FSA programs. If you choose ARC, it cannot because it kind of replicates ARC with some important distinctions and features. And then whole farm revenue is another one that is really gaining in popularity. It is a little bit more intrusive. It asks for some of your tax records and that kind of stuff. But particularly if you're a diversified farm, it can really provide a quality level of coverage. I'm not going to talk about the Farm Bill so much, but there were some key provisions and generally supportive provisions on crop insurance of all types, including research pilots for new products for more crops. So that's what we want to see. It still has, I will say, despite the best efforts of the EWG and AEI and others who want to go after crop insurance year after year, we've been able to mount a very strong defense, and because I think it makes sense. It's showing great value to you as producers and to the members of Congress who authorize this program. Is providing a good return on the investment. Just to provide a little bit of information about where you can go to get more information about crop insurance, and this is what we were asked to do by the RMA. They have a great website. It's been redone, and there's really some quality information on there, and whether it's about preventive planning, which was the big issue for last year, or whole farm revenue, if you're interested in looking at that for this season. Of course, sales closing day is March 15th. It's coming up. So there's a lot of activity on federal crop insurance right now. But the RMA website is actually a really good resource. They have frequently asked questions by topic. One of the key things is they have an agent finder. So if you don't have a good agent, this is a good place to start. Obviously, I think you want to ask around your peers and fellows of who should I go see? Who are the people that are really working overtime to provide a quality service? Not just for crop insurance, but how it lines up with the other risk management profile on your farm. And there are a lot of really good agents out there. It's important to find that good agent. Whether it's new programs like Whole Farm Revenue, Organic, and all the various little things that they do, the USDA website really has tremendous information. They work hard to keep it up to date. And to keep you apprised, crop insurance is a rules-based program, so it's important to stay apprised of those rules. And that's, again, why it's so important to work with a good agent, because they'll sort through a lot of that information for you. So, John, I'm going to stop there. I know we'll have questions at the end, and I would love to take any questions other than what I've covered about kind of how things are going in Washington, D.C. and that type of stuff. But it's a pleasure to be with you today, and thanks again for all you do as farmers to support this great nation.
Thanks, Tom. We wanted to have Tom speak because he always does such a really good job given that historical perspective on crop insurance and kind of what goes on behind the scenes. I think a lot of times crop insurance is a set it and forget it kind of program for us. We do maybe what we did last year and maybe what we did the year before and maybe even 5 years ago, and we don't give that a whole lot of thought. So I like the historical perspective and talking about a little more deeply what goes on in crop insurance that maybe we don't see. A couple of housekeeping items, of course, Tom said. We'll do questions at the end. We've got a microphone that'll be floating around for that. If you haven't yet, pre and post assessments on the blue piece of paper, fill out the pre now. And if you'd fill out the post afterward, it would be extremely helpful for us. Now I want to introduce Rich Morrison to talk specifics on markets and some of the technical aspects of marketing and how that ties to crop insurance. Rich, of course, works for NAU Country Insurance Company. He's got a long background in marketing and exactly how that ties to crop insurance. Rich?
Okay, well, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. Just a little about myself before I dig in to talking markets, which most of us probably don't really care to talk about today, given the week that we've had. But I began in the grain business 32 years ago. Worked as a grain buyer, merchandiser for a number of years. 20 years ago, kind of switched over to the risk management side of the business, which includes crop insurance, include commodity brokerage, and working with producers on markets. And my role is pretty unique in the crop insurance business. We've got a ton of experts out there that can talk to you and give you good information on crop insurance policy. My role then is to try to visit with you about revenue and how to generate revenue, how to lock in revenue, how to utilize your policy to be able to, the guarantee in your policy, to be able to lock in prices on the marketing side. So that's what we'll dig into here today. Found this on Twitter the other day. I thought it was a pretty interesting quote, and I think most people would agree that marketing is easier once you accept that markets are often irrational. Anybody agree with that? We've seen a lot of irrational market trade in the last week or so. You can't explain it someday. And I said, I think the worst job that I could think of right now would be a writer for DTN that every afternoon you got to come up with a reason why the market did what it did that day. So fortunately, we're not doing that. But this is kind of points out the reason why we need to have a plan and why you can utilize your crop insurance guarantee and build a plan that when you get to levels, you can lock in profits. We go ahead and do it and utilize the tools we've got to be able to do that. So to me, my focus for 2020 has to be on selecting the right crop insurance coverage for my farm. That may include just multi-peril, it may include hail, wind, it may have some other add-ons as well, but getting that set in place, then choosing the right government program. We've got, 2 weeks left to pick between PLC and ARC. That's a whole other meeting on its own, but we won't dig into that today. But then finally, utilizing a variety of risk management or marketing tools to be able to set these revenue numbers when we get the chance to do it. And this is how it really all boils together in building a plan. So anytime you get, by the way, all of the above is usually the right answer when it's on any of your tests. So it is today as well. So crop insurance. When you think about a crop insurance policy, a revenue insurance policy, and this is where it kind of starts to mix in with marketing, there's three components, really, or three options that are built into a revenue policy. Most of you probably don't think about crop insurance having options, but it really does. A crop insurance revenue policy contains a price put option. So you could go to the marketplace today and go buy a put option on the Chicago Board of Trade or the other exchanges, but your policy contains a price put. In other words, if the price goes down far enough at the end of the year from February to October, you could trigger a payment on crop insurance just because of the drop in the price. So it does depend a little bit on your yield, but that put option is built in your policy. You have a yield put option. It's essentially what a policy is. If your yield falls below a certain level, you're going to get paid. And you'll get an indemnity payment. You know that at the beginning of the year when you enter into the policy, using your APH, what your guaranteed bushels are. And then the last one is a price call option. You know, we recognize that. We've had years like 2012 where the price goes up in the fall from what it was back in the spring. And when that happens, you get to recalculate your insurance guarantee based on that higher fall price. So we often don't think about a revenue policy in terms of options, but really that's all it is. It's built three different options. And the great part about this, you get this to buy this at a subsidized rate. You know, as Tom was talking about, these policies are subsidized, some of them more than 50% even. SCO, I think 65%. So there's some good opportunities to buy some of these options packaged together at a pretty cheap premium. Where are prices today? Well, we're starting to inch a little lower. Much of the country is setting base prices right now. We had some of the southern areas that had it done 2 weeks ago. Corn average as of last night was running at $3.89 for the majority of the country. That's down from $4 a year ago. Sorghum price is at $3.69 compared to $3.94 last year. Soybeans at $9.18, that's down. And the cotton price was set for the southern areas at 70 cents already compared to 78 last year. So we know our guarantees are going to be a little lower, but we also know our premiums probably will be down a little bit as well. So kind of digging into the markets, you know, right now, if you go back 30 days ago, this is what everybody's been talking about, this China trade deal. This was going to be the big deal for us. And unfortunately, we'll talk about in a second what's changed since then. But this is kind of what the trade deal with China would look like if it comes to fruition. If you go back to 2017, they used that year as the baseline for coming up with this agreement. And in 2017, we shipped $19 billion worth of ag products to China. So going forward, China has agreed that in 2020, they're going to buy $12.5 billion additional dollars worth of ag products. And in 2021, they're going to add an additional $19.5 billion. So just looking at this chart, this would be amazing for U.S. agriculture if it gets to fruition. So is there some concern about that? Has China ever reneged on a trade deal before? Yeah. So, you know, yes, there is some concern. But certainly this beats what we had before, which was just kind of shooting from the hip. So we've gotten them to at least agree that there's a structure in place that they're going to try to abide by. So this is a good thing for us going forward. However, we've got some hurdles. We're all recognizing it right now. It's what's impacted the markets the last, really, 10 days or so. The coronavirus. This is a few days old, and I know these numbers continue to get bigger each day. But that has really put the clamps on markets in general, not just the ag markets, but we all watch the stock market, the oil market, the even some of the metals markets, things like that, coming under some severe pressure due to this outbreak. And the fear, I mean, it's a fear market, and that's what futures markets tend to do. They tend to trade on what you think's going to happen. And right now, everybody's just in risk-off mode. Nobody wants to be committed in these markets at the moment, not sure what's going to happen. And so at the moment, that's what's happening. We couldn't wait for this weekend to get here quick enough to shut the markets down for a couple of days, at least give everybody a breather and see what happens over the weekend. But certainly if you're China, are you worried about a phase one trade deal right now and worried about buying enough product to fit that or to fill that that order? Or are you worried about trying to build hospitals? You know, you can't blame them. That's what their focus has been. And it's amazing they can build a hospital over there in 2 weeks, isn't it? You know, I don't know if we can build one in 2 years here, but certainly their standards may be a little different. But that's been the focus right now from the Chinese. It's on how to control this outbreak. But this is a picture of the Shanghai Stock Index going back to the beginning of the year. You can see what happened in January. Just completely fell out of bed. And that's kind of what's starting to happen here a little bit in our markets. So the R word's being tossed around, recession. There's generally some concern that consumers are going to stop spending. At least in that country there is. And so that's caused a pullback in their economy. The other big story is acres. You can see what happened to planted acres last year in the United States. We were down about 16 million total planted acres from the previous year. Now, the question in 2020 is, will all or most of those acres get planted this year? And I thought this was going to be the story of 2020 when we flipped the calendar. The coronavirus outbreak kind of slid in on us. That was kind of our black swan event for the year. But to me, this is still the focus for most of us from a fundamental perspective, is what happens to these additional acres. Last week, the Ag Outlook Forum met out in D.C. These were the numbers that they came up with. These are their estimates as of right now. We've had a few others. Farm Futures and Forma Commodities have been putting out estimates as well. I think everyone's in agreement that corn and soybean acres are going to jump fairly dramatically this year. Based on the pullback that we had last year, most of those acres will come back into production. But you can see their estimates. They expect wheat acres to be about the same, cotton to drop a little bit. Sorghum acres are expected to increase, as is corn this coming year. But overall acreage, they're projecting up about 12.7 million acres. So I don't disagree. I think that we could still see some shifting in the mix. I think between cotton and sorghum, I think between soybeans and cotton in the Mid-South, I think corn soybean acres in the upper in the Midwest still could tug back and forth a little bit. USDA will put out its planting intentions report on March 31st. That'll be their first official survey of acres for this coming year. So I'll start out looking at some of the markets, the feed grain markets, the corn, sorghum market, really being impacted right now by the strong U.S. dollar. And unfortunately for us in the room, we benefit when we're selling things overseas by a weaker dollar. And that's what we're up against right now. There's been a number of reasons why the dollar has been on a two-year run to the upside. China has devalued its yuan currency against the dollar. Brazil has continued to press the real down versus the dollar. Argentina with the peso. And these weaker currencies, basically, they're making those countries, their commodities, cheaper relative to U.S. commodities. And we're really seeing that impact in the feed grain markets right now. Brazil has taken a big chunk of our corn export business this year. And so one thing that would certainly help us a lot would be to see the dollar start to weaken a little bit. But the dollar has also been seen kind of as a safe haven. If you're an investor, you know, you probably have a little more faith in the U.S. dollar going forward than possibly in commodities or even in stocks at the moment, given this coronavirus outbreak. So you can see the impact on exports. The black line is this marketing year, and you can see we're struggling a little bit in corn right now. And again, part of that's because Brazil, Argentina had big crops last year, but because of the weaker or the stronger dollar, the weaker currencies that they've got, they're being able to ship a little more. So you would think that the drop in the market price would help, but certainly if you want to root for something this winter, root for the dollar to weaken. So we look at the balance sheet. This is the corn balance sheet from USDA last month. Looking ahead, we're expecting bigger acres, corn, sorghum, feed grains in general. And if you expect bigger acres without a huge jump in demand, we would expect stocks are probably likely to grow out here into the summer of 2021. These are my numbers. I'm projecting stocks possibly upwards of 2.8 billion bushels of corn next year, which would likely mean prices would probably dip a little bit in the year ahead. I put a 350 price for corn. The Ag Outlook Forum last week said 360. Informa Commodities was saying 330 in one of their recent letters. So I don't think anybody disagrees just based on the numbers. If we raise stocks by that big of an amount, we would likely see prices weaken. So if you're an investor, if you're a hedge fund trader, do you want to be long the corn market today? Probably not. You want to be long many ag markets right now. You know, it's just hard to build that enthusiasm. And you can see this is a picture of their net position in corn futures over the last 6 years. And the black line is so far this marketing year. And they continue to stay on the short side of the corn market. Now, there's a couple of ways to look at that. You could look at that and say, well, everybody's a little negative right now because of the lack of demand and the bigger acres. Or you could look at that and say, well, they're short corn today. And if something happens positive, they've got some buying power just to get back to unchanged. So, you know, there's a couple of different ways you can look at that. And especially last year is the red line. Look what happened back in April last year. They were holding a record short position in the corn market. And we remember what happened in much of the country come April, May last year. We had trouble getting crops in the ground, and these people got spooked and started buying back their short position. Bought 500,000 contracts of corn in about a 6-7 week window, rallied corn futures a dollar a bushel. So it can happen, and certainly once everybody gets all, you know, get all your chips on one side of the table, you know, things can change in a hurry. So if you want to be positive, you know, certainly going forward, the fact that they're short already probably gives them some buying power if we do get an acreage scare or something changes this spring. So looking at D's futures, new crop corn. And we'll look back at this in a few minutes when we talk about crop insurance. But you can see what the markets have done so far over the last few days. We have dipped down and made some new contract lows in the December contract, traded down to 376 and a quarter. That was this morning when I updated the chart. I've still been a proponent of selling some $4 corn. I don't think we've been hurt at all if you've hedged futures above $4 in the last 6 years plus. So I think that's a great target. It's kind of slipped away from us a little bit here in the near term. But the one thing that I also point out on this chart, look down at the very bottom, these indicators, the relative strength index is the green line, and the red and the blue lines are the stochastics. And I like to use these tools just to kind of monitor what the market looks like. Is the market overbought or oversold? And long story short, you look at the RSI, typically when we dip under 30, that to me is a buy signal. It means the market's probably overdone. Now, it may not happen right away, but right now you've got the RSI at about 27, 28. So it would indicate to me this market's probably oversold, probably due for some correction here in the coming days or week or so. So I would be able to be patient trying to market for right now, but and we'll talk about some of that here in a minute. Soybean market. Big issue soybeans have had this last year. Yes, trade and tariffs have been one, but it's this African swine fever outbreak in China. And the fact that China hog numbers are expected to be at a 27-year low this year. And, you know, dead pigs don't eat, right? So we're trying to sell beans to China, and China doesn't need as many soybeans. And until they get these pig numbers built back up, you know, it's going to be difficult to get that market. So here's the impact on sales. The green line is last year. The black line is so far this year. Sales have picked up to China a little bit, but we need more of that. And unfortunately, the coronavirus outbreak has kind of put a stop on this for the moment. So if and when that gets figured out, we hear some good things that China's ports are starting to get emptied out again. So maybe business is starting to pick up over there. If you're optimistic, you would assume then that maybe China's going to get the market here pretty soon. So looking at the balance sheet on beans, you know, going forward, well, this past year we had a big drop in stocks, and that was due to the decrease in acres. That was a big reason for that. We cut 13 million acres out of soybean production this year, took stocks down over 50% from the previous year. Going forward, we're expecting big acres, maybe 10, 8, 9, whatever million more acres this year. But I'm also optimistic for demand. I think we'll see some better demand numbers in the year ahead, partly because of the trade deal. And stocks probably would still grow a little bit. And so if that's the case, you would expect price to maybe be the same or a little bit easier in 2021. The funds, we mentioned a minute ago what they've been doing in corn. Soybeans, they've been all over the place. And most of their reaction in the bean market has been whether we were going to get a trade deal done or not. And 1 week, it seems like we're getting closer to a deal. Funds start buying beans. Next week, we don't. Funds sell beans. And that's been, you know, pretty much explains what's happened to the bean market over the last year plus. And here's kind of what it looked like on the chart. You know, you've seen a lot of peaks and valleys in the bean market. And that's all been driven by funds, hedge funds, getting in and out of this market. Now, lately, of course, there's been a lot of selling, mainly due to the coronavirus outbreak. And we've just seen selling across the board in commodities. But I think a reasonable target, has been $9.50 a bushel on November beans. I would want to start getting some beans hedged quite a bit there at that level. I think you can make some money there. And I also think if we're thinking we're going to plant 8 to 10 million more acres this year, that I'd like to have a lot of beans sold before the planter goes in the ground this spring. The wheat market. You know, wheat, for a change, we haven't been able to say this for a few years, but wheat's finally had some positive news. Number one, acreage. Winter wheat acres, I believe, are going to be the lowest this year since 1909, I believe it is. So it's just incredible the change that we've seen in U.S. agriculture and the amount of wheat acres getting planted. The other positive news for the market, not necessarily if you live in Australia, but the positive news for the market has been this is the second straight year that we've seen a poor Australian wheat crop. And we finally, after 7-8 years, saw back-to-back bad crops somewhere in the world. We just have continued to raise really good wheat crops everywhere in the world. So the fact that Australia's been out of the export market, we've been able to pick up some export business. Even some of the, like, soft wheat, which typically we don't get a whole lot, we're starting to see some business. So that's been a positive here. Here's a picture of wheat sales, the black line this year, and you can kind of see that we've started to see some optimism here. You know, not real rosy, but it's, you know, we're right now the second best we've been in the last 6 years. So that's the one thing that's been positive. And when you look at the balance sheet, and going forward, especially if demand continues to be decent on wheat, then we would expect stocks. I'm figuring 850 million bushels out into next year. And so I think that would be a little bit positive to the wheat market. And we've seen some of that already factored in. When you look at what the hedge funds have been doing, this is Chicago wheat. But they're finally long Chicago wheat. And you look at the last, 8 years, they've spent very little time on the long side of the wheat market. And rightfully so. We just have not been able to get over the hump, get below this billion bushel number here in the U.S. stocks until recently. And so that's created a little bit of a positive swing in the wheat market. So Chicago wheat, you can see the impact. You know, you go back here when the funds were short back in September to where they're at today. You look at it on the chart, we went from 468 to 589. It was a $1.20 rally. So they gave us a tremendous opportunity here. Now, in recent days, weeks, of course, wheat's not immune to the selling we've seen in all of our markets, and we've seen the market sell back down a little bit. Indicators also really showing this market pushing into oversold status right now. So that said, you know, if we were able to trade up around 545, 540, which was that peak we had back in the fall, I think I would be interested in getting some wheat sold here for this year. Kansas City wheat, for the hard wheat guys, we did see the funds reverse that position from holding what at the time was the biggest short position they'd had in the fall to actually long wheat here in the last few weeks. So again, the Chicago market has kind of helped pull this market up with it, but that's provided some upside. And you can kind of see up until today or yesterday, we kind of had a nice little uptrend line going, but we did dip below that. But still, we had a dollar rally in the wheat market. So that's 25% rally in wheat. That's incredible to think that we could see that kind of a rally. And it wasn't because of U.S. production fears. It was because of demand. And so that's, I think, reasons for some optimism in wheat as we go forward. The cotton market, what's really helped cotton futures in the last few months has been the dip in the U.S. yield numbers. Now, certainly that hasn't been a great deal for producers, but the futures market took notice of this and has really started to put some premium back into the market. And the balance sheet numbers have come down. About 3-4 months ago, USDA was projecting stocks of cotton to be 7 million bales at the end of this year, and that number's come down now to 5.4 million bales. And so that's given some life back to this cotton market, which had come under some pretty sharp pressure last spring and summer. Looking ahead, Informa, they're saying 13 million acres of cotton this year. Some have said down to 12.5. I don't think we're going to dip that far. I think 13 is probably a decent number to start with. But even with that type of an acreage number, if we're somewhat optimistic to demand, I think stocks should come down just a little bit in the year ahead. So I would think average price should be a little higher out into 2021. The funds, I mentioned just a second ago, what they've done. They started their rally back in August. They went from a record short position in cotton futures to, as of last Friday, long about 30,000 contracts of cotton. So again, I think they've recognized that stocks have come back down to a manageable level. There was reason to maybe try to buy a few acres of cotton back because we were talking about acres slipping to some other crops this year. So as I look ahead to new crop, again, it's been pretty brutal the last few days. And we'll talk about this with insurance in just a second. But you can see the sell-off we've had basically back to the fall lows again. So it hasn't been immune, just like a lot of the markets, to the coronavirus sell-off that we've seen here recently. The only good news, the RSI, down below 20 right now. So this market very, very oversold, probably a buying opportunity for any end users right now. So going ahead, what's going to happen? Well, to me, the next few weeks, these are probably the biggest storylines. The coronavirus impact, the fear, you know, how much fear remains in the market, because fear right now is what's driving the markets. If we take some of that fear out, you know, certainly it can allow our markets to come back, and I think it's a good buying opportunity right now. Actual Chinese purchases. This is what we've been lacking. Even before the coronavirus really became an issue, we've been waiting for China to step up. And every day would go by, it seemed like the market started to drift a little bit easier. So if and when China starts to buy, I think that could give us a real boost and probably give us a bounce. South American weather, you know, it's something we haven't talked about at all this winter. Normally this, you know, in the wintertime, we'd be focusing a lot on South America. But this year, because of the other issues with China, that's kind of been pushed to the back burner. But Brazil right now forecasted to have a record bean crop, probably a pretty good corn crop as well. Argentina maybe down a little bit due to some dry weather, but looks like some pretty decent crops as well. So we'll see if that changes going forward. And then any adjustments to last year's crop? If you recall back in January, USDA did leave the door open to go back and resurvey corn production in 5 states, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and 3 states on soybeans. I don't expect that to happen today or tomorrow, but I think as you get out into spring, that could happen. I did see a note yesterday that 61% of the North Dakota corn crop has been harvested now. So there's still 39% of the crop in the field. And so I don't think that's going to come off anytime real soon. The last thing on here I still think is probably as important as any this year, how many of these acres come back into production. If it's a lot, you know, it could actually continue to weigh on prices out into this year. So what can we do right now? I mentioned some ideas on the markets, maybe for some hedging, but keep in mind your revenue policy. Utilize your revenue policy as a price put option. Most of us don't want to go out and sell today, right? We you know, this market's been really overcooked. I don't think any of us want to go sell today. But think about the put option that's been built in your policy. I mentioned this a minute ago. The green lines on here, the top green line on December corn chart, that's about where this crop insurance base price is going to get set. The bottom green line is 85% of that level. So in other words, if I bought an 85% revenue policy, and I raised a yield this year that matched my APH, then I would have some price support down around the 330 level. Now, that sounds like a long way down, but who knows? If we have a dip in bushel or a dip in yield, then that price floor actually starts to come up a little bit. And we don't know what's going to happen the rest of this year. So to me, at least I know that if I do nothing else today, which I don't intend to do on the marketing side, that I do have some price protection down below the market. Here's cotton. Cotton's even closer right now, and I put on an 80% line. If I bought an 80% revenue policy on cotton in the southern states, we started with a 70-cent price. 20% drop in price is only down to 56 cents. That's not far from where we're at today. So again, if you do nothing else today, remember you've got this put option that's built into your policy. And you might want to even consider, you know, for some of you, sales closing might be tomorrow or today, you know, maybe you look at going up a level if that gets me extra price protection, because I'm buying that price built into my policy at 70 cents right now. Up in the northern states, 69 cents. So it's a lot, you know, quite a ways above where the market's currently trading. Maybe that's a smart move to get that extra price built into my policy this year. The yield put option, of course, that's always there. It's a big deal. It was a big deal last year. It was a big deal in many areas last year. We had a lot of prevented plant, a lot of replant. So keep that in mind. And a lot of us learned a lot about the ins and outs of a prevented plant claim last year. But keep in mind that you've got that that's built into that policy. And then utilizing the price call option that's built into your policy to back up your sales. You know, most of us, what's the biggest fear we have in marketing? Your fear is, two, probably one, that we won't grow that much, and two, that I'm going to sell too soon and the market's going to keep going higher. Fear of regret. And so this kind of helps that, because you have that upward price adjustment in the fall. What happens if I don't raise my bushels, and what happens if the market goes up? I get paid back on lost bushels at that higher price in the fall. So it should help us sleep a little better at night. If I'm wrong, the market goes up, at least I know I've got that built into my policy. So my marketing strategies I like, I mentioned some of these a minute ago. I like to hedge December corn above $4. I'd like to be pretty aggressive at that level. November beans, $9.50 and above. I want to be pretty aggressive, given the fact that we think we're going to have more acres. Chicago wheat, $5.40. Kansas City wheat, $5 in the July contract. And cotton at the 70-cent level. Probably not as aggressive seller of cotton, since we expect acres to dip a little bit this year, but I still think it makes sense to start getting some hedge there. The other strategy that I've liked, and I unfortunately we can't do these today, but the strategy I like this year is an option-based strategy. It's a min-max or a floor and a ceiling, whatever you want to call it. But if we think that we're going to increase acreage of all crops, but especially in corn and soybeans, if acres are going to go up this year, what's that probably going to do to the upside potential in the market? It's probably going to limit it, right, if we're going to increase a lot of acres. So I like the idea of selling an out-of-the-money call option. Collect the premium and use that to pay for a put option. Essentially, get myself a higher floor if I'm willing to accept a ceiling. And what I've been talking about this winter is maybe do one for one. Maybe I hedge a contract of corn at $4, do this on a contract of corn when corn's at $4. And so these were what I was looking at back on the January the 2nd. On corn, I was trying to buy a 380 put, sell a 450 call. That day, that spread was trading at 0 net cents a bushel. So I could have had a floor at 380 if I'm willing to accept a ceiling at 4.5, and it cost me nothing out of pocket. The only thing I have to do is maintain margin on a short option. Would everybody be willing to hedge corn at 450? I think we all would. The risk would be, as if corn went to $5, I'd be maxed out at 450. I just don't see that likely to happen this year with more acres getting planted. Soybeans. cotton in the blue. That day, I was looking at buying a 71-cent put, 74-cent, selling a 74-cent call. That time, it was only cost me 0.3 cents, so almost free. I could have had a floor at 71. That's a dime above where the market's at today. So it would have been a great deal. Unfortunately, we can't today, but if we get back somewhere reasonably close to where we were back in early January, I want to be aggressive and be ready to pull the trigger. Same on soybeans. Back then, I was looking at a 960 put and selling a 1040 call. The net cost was about 9 cents. Would have given me a net floor at 951 and a net ceiling at 1031. So I like this type of a trade in this type of a year. Normally, in a normal year, I don't really participate in options this early, but I think this is not a normal year, and we've seen that in the last few weeks. So with bigger acres expected, with impact potentially from China, I like the idea of getting floors put under this market. Utilizing your crop insurance policy, the options built into that as well, getting the right government program signed up for. If I can put these three things together before I go to the field this spring, I think there's a chance we can still have a decent year this year. So to me, that's the focus, picking the right policy, choosing the government program, and utilizing my marketing tools. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you, and I'll stick around if you've got any questions. So thank you.
Okay, so it looks like we have about 5 minutes. Maybe we have time for probably two questions, and then, of course, they'll stick around for a few minutes after.
Question for Mr. Sell. Could you comment on the legislation that was introduced earlier this month, the Affirm Act, by Senator Toomey and Senator Sheehan, and what that would mean to us as farmers if that were to pass?
I'm glad you asked the question. So I'd mentioned in my presentation that crop insurance and really all ag policy draws an inordinate amount of negative attention. Crop insurance has become the focus of groups like the EWG, and this Affirm Act is been around now in the last three or four Congresses. It is the brainchild of the Environmental Working Group, and it has five elements. So Ron Kind from Wisconsin has introduced it in the House many times. Now Shaheen and Toomey, Shaheen from New Hampshire and Toomey from Pennsylvania have introduced it. Bipartisan. Shaheen's a Democrat. Toomey is a Republican. It does basically five things. One, it eliminates the harvest price option. So we all like the revenue component, the put, as you say, on the, that is embedded into the federal crop insurance program. So it eliminates the harvest price option. It requires publication of all contractual data. So think of the EWG database that they do on FSA payments, where they try and shame farmers. They would do the same thing with federal crop insurance data. They reduce the amount of underwriting gains that AIPs can make in federal crop insurance, and it's an arbitrary number. It's packaged for good marketing. So, kind of, why should any company be able to make above this amount? It also places pay limits on the amount of premium subsidy that producers can benefit from. So, it's all cost share, right? So, you're paying a significant portion of the premium, but it would eliminate the amount. It would limit the amount of premium subsidy or premium cost share that the federal government could pay to $50,000 per producer. Those are four of the five elements. I can't remember the other, but it's really meant as a poison pill, as a way to really undermine the federal crop insurance program. And I think it would have a really deleterious impact on the program and certainly on the producers it serves. So it's one of those things that we try and rally people to be against. We were able to beat it on the 14 Farm Bill. We also beat a version of it where it actually never made it to a vote in this most recent 18 Farm Bill process. But that's where we got to just continue to stand together. Thanks for the question.
One more. Okay, well, we appreciate y'all coming. Please fill out these post-assessment forms on the blue sheet. And if you fill out the pre, turn those in as well, or you can leave them in your seat, and we'll pick them up. Appreciate you coming.